House Human Services will come to order. Will the secretary please take the roll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Sheldon Galloway?
Here.
Vice Chair Buckley?
Here.
Representative Regeer?
Excused.
Representative Etchart?
Excused.
Representative Oblander?
Here.
Representative Hawk?
Here.
Representative Nikolakakos?
Here.
Representative Hinkle?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Here.
Representative Welch?
Here.
Representative Staffman?
Here.
Representative Abbott?
Here.
Representative Zephyr?
Here.
Representative Frazier?
Excused.
Representative Howell?
Here.
Representative Yakowicz?
Here.
Representative Ask?
Here.
Representative Marshall?
Here.
Representative Nickel?
Here.
Representative Buttry?
Excused.
Chair Carlson?
Here.
That is all, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Katie. Members, we're going to hear the bills in the order of House Bill 200 and then House Bill 29. Representative Sheldon Galloway will be the presiding chair today, as I will be going to do a bill upstairs, and then I will be here to introduce the bill in here. So, Chair Sheldon Galloway.
Welcome to House Human Services today. I would like to make something so you don't get confused in the audience. If Representative Marshall and Representative Nickel could change your name plaques, you might get called the wrong name today. Thank you. Thank you. We'll now hear House Bill 200 by Representative Essman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon to members of the committee. You have before you today a bill that was requested by a constituent of mine that will revise the Montana Safe Haven Newborn Protection Act. This bill would clarify that a newborn may be surrendered anonymously in a newborn safety device or by placing an emergency call to an appropriate emergency services provider. Members of the committee, the current act does not specify that the newborn may be surrendered anonymously. So we hope by providing a safe vehicle by which an anonymous surrender can take place, we may save more babies from being abandoned in a tragic and often deadly manner. There are currently 134 newborn safety devices in operation in 9 states, and 23 babies have been safely surrendered, since this project started in 2017 in Indiana. I would urge you to vote in favor of this bill so that we can offer another viable solution to parents who find themselves in desperate situations. Madam Chair, at the risk of oversharing, may I submit a couple of handouts?
Yes, you may. Please.
Thank you. There's two of them, so I'll start them down each side.
Okay. Thank you.
So the one that you will be getting looks like this, and it is a picture of Monica, who is the founder of Safe Haven Baby Boxes, and it shows you a picture of what an actual installed newborn safety device looks like. And so that's some good reference. And the mission statement is from her organization that provides these boxes. The second handout is a list of arguments against Safe Haven baby boxes and how Monica and the organization answer those questions. So many of your questions may be answered on this sheet, but we would welcome questions. And I will stand down so that you may discuss and ask. ask questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Essman. We'll now take testimony for proponents and opponents. I will start with proponents. Is there a raise of hand of how many proponents are in the room today for this bill? Thank you. And do we have anybody online for this bill?
Madam Chair, we do have two proponents online.
You're coming in almost real sketchy. If you could work on that while we're listening to proponents in the room, that would be nice. Thank you. Proponents for House Bill 200.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jill Bushman. I'm sorry, reading this was probably going to choke me up. That's B-U-S-H-M-A-N. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm here to support the change to the Safe Haven Law to allow for newborn safety devices in HB 200. A year ago, I read a story about a baby being abandoned in a dumpster in New Mexico. I was in shock. As a wife and mom of four kiddos, I couldn't imagine. I couldn't imagine putting my baby in a bag to be discarded, let alone a dumpster. I began to wonder if this had ever happened in Montana. A brief internet search, and there it was. A Missoula story, news story about a baby that had been abandoned in a dumpster behind a bowling alley in 1999. A teenager walking by at midnight heard her cry, and she was rescued and lived. This case was a contributor to the Montana Safe Haven Law put into effect in 2001. 20 years later, we are still seeing traumatized moms putting their babies in dumpsters across America. My heart goes out to these women who feel this is their only option. When we install a newborn safety device, we will create one more option, one more chance to avoid tragedy. This safety device will be the last resort. When I began working with Representative Essman, I realized this has happened more often than I thought, and certainly more often than it should. In 2022 alone, there have been news reports of 59 infant abandonments in the nation. Just last week, while speaking to a friend about this bill, she shared with me the story of a family member whose life began 28 years ago when she was rescued from a dumpster in Butte, Montana. Her biological mother, a woman who was struggling with her mental health while concealing a pregnancy from her family, delivered a baby in the bathroom. She wrapped the baby in blankets and disposed of her in the dumpster. Fortunately, after several hours, the baby girl was found. Thank goodness tragedy was avoided. After a brief hospital stay and 9 months in foster care, she was adopted and that little girl was on her way. The birth mom, who ended up in the hospital due to complications from the birth, was thus identified, and because of the abandonment, served time in jail. I shudder to think how many babies have been discarded that never became known. The true number may never be known. This is a small, simple step that we can take that will give both mother and child a possibility to avoid a tragedy. I want to thank you for your time and encourage you to vote in favor of HB 200. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next proponent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Pam Western, W-E-S-T-E-R-N. On August 7th, gosh dang it, what's about standing here? It makes you emotional, I guess. On August 7th, 2003, we received a phone call about a newborn baby boy. The social worker said it was highly probable that he would be available for adoption. He had been surrendered under the Safe Haven Law to a fire station in Bozeman. 2 hours later, we held him in our arms. Sorry. Fast forward 19 years. He's a freshman in college, 4.0 student, playing on a baseball scholarship. I could talk to you all day about how proud I am of Andrew, but I do eventually want you to be able to vote yes on this bill, so I'll make it quick. I don't think that Andrew's birth mom maybe fits the stereotype, I guess, that maybe you might have in your mind when you think about a mother in a crisis situation with a newborn who's desperately looking for an option that she feels confident and safe with. She was a college graduate, was starting out her career in Bozeman. I don't know the circumstances of her situation, but I know that she had an unwanted pregnancy and she needed a solution for handling that. And so, yeah, I know that she wasn't planning to be pregnant or to be a mom at that time in her life. When Andrew was born, she gave birth to him. She was alone in her home, and she really hadn't made a plan for how she was, you know, she hadn't gone to an adoption agency or had any prenatal care. And she had heard about the safe haven law. And so after 2 days of caring for him in her home, she took him to the local fire station where she was helped and met by a local social worker. And Andrew was then handed off to the Child and Family Services in Bozeman. When we got Andrew, he didn't have a name yet, and his older brother was really bothered by that. He was 4.5 years old, and he proclaimed that we should call him Switcher, was his name, which is interesting because now Andrew is playing baseball in college and is a switch hitter. So if Andrew were here to testify today, I'm pretty sure he would want you all to know that he is thankful for his life and that he was given the opportunity to live and have the life that he's had so far. In the days that followed his surrender, I was personally really overcome by thoughts of what his birth mom had just gone through, hiding her pregnancy, giving birth by herself, and then having to decide what she was going to do next. I've said this before, but his birth mom is my hero. I think she made a very difficult decision that took a lot of courage. I'm not sure that his birth mom, you know, would have ever considered an unsafe option for him. But when Jill called me just yesterday, actually, to tell me about House Bill 200, I thought this is another option to add in addition to the safe haven law that gives moms another level of anonymity. I believe there could be mothers who, even though with the safe haven law, their anonymity is protected, they still might feel better just being able to do something completely anonymous where they don't even have to talk to another person. So anyways, obviously, I'm a huge proponent of the bill, and I hope that you will vote yes on House Bill 200. Thank you.
Thank you. Next proponent.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Johanna Kennedy, Kennedy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I stand here today as a parent, a foster parent, a former director of Young Lives, which is a ministry to teen moms and their babies, and now the current co-director of Haven Camps, which we run summer camps for children in foster care in Montana. And I would ask you all to vote in favor of HB 200. Our first foster child was a newborn baby boy we picked up from the hospital. Over the months of parental visits, we had the opportunity to become acquainted with his birth mother. She struggled deeply with the pull between her love for her son and her addiction. In the end, she chose to relinquish her rights, sharing with us that she knew she wasn't in a situation to properly care for her son. It was truly one of the heaviest days when we sat in that courtroom with her son next to her as she surrendered her rights. She was an incredibly brave person, and she chose her son's well-being over her own desires. What I like about the safe haven law and the newborn safety device is that they allow for the protection of both the mom and the child. The newborn safety device allows for mothers who love their babies but either know or feel they can't provide the situation their baby needs to courageously surrender their child into a place where that little one has the hope of securing a home in which he or she can learn and grow and thrive. I like that the mother has the option to make this choice early in the child's life, rather than have that possibility taken away from them if their situation decided that. Last year at camp, we had 47 kids ages 7 to 11 who are currently involved with CPS. Some of the stories of their lives before entering foster care shocked me. I thought I had heard it all, and I had not. If even one of those precious children would have been surrendered at birth to a newborn safety device in anonymity or at a fire station, years of trauma and abuse could have been avoided. Some of the teen moms that I met over the years lived in pretty dangerous situations, which meant that their babies were also in these situations. I can't help but wonder if we would have had one of these devices during those years, if one of them would have chosen to surrender their child for the sake of his or her safety or well-being. In all this, my heart does break for the moms and the dads. Having four biological children, I know the fierce feeling of love that comes with birthing a child. And then I know the determination that's intense to provide the best circumstances I can for my child. The same in love and determination is displayed by a mom or a dad who looks at their life and knows that a safe, anonymous surrender of their sweet baby may provide the best hope for their child's future. If we could even save one baby in Montana because of the anonymity or the offered of the installation of the newborn safety device, it would be worth it. Thank you for your time, and I encourage you to vote in favor of HB 200.
Thank you. Another proponent?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Human Services Committee. My name is Heather O'Hara, O apostrophe capital H-A-R-A. I'm a master's prepared RN and the vice president at the Montana Hospital Association. MHA stands in support of House Bill 200 and would like to thank Representative Essman for sponsoring this bill, and we do ask for a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any more proponents in the room? Do we have any proponents online?
Madam Chair, I believe we have Jesse Browning online as a proponent.
Jesse Browning.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Jesse Browning. That's B-R-O-W-N-I-N-G. I'm a mom of four children, and I represent myself. I ask you to please vote yes to HB 200. This bill will provide an opportunity for towns to decide if they want to implement a baby box in their community. I just spoke yesterday with someone who moved here from California. She was surprised to hear that we do not have any baby boxes in Montana. She has seen them implemented there in California, and precious lives were saved. Years ago, my relative was able to adopt a baby that had been thrown into a dumpster by a mentally ill mom in a small rural town in Montana. The little baby has flourished and grown up to be a woman in her 20s. These things do happen. Every single life is precious, and we must do what we can to stand up for the children who are not able to stand up for themselves. Please vote yes to HB 200. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any other proponents online?
Madam Chair, we have Monica Kelsey as a proponent online.
Thank you. Monica?
Good afternoon. My name is Monica Kelsey. I am the founder and current CEO of Safe Haven Baby Boxes. We are the ones that are actually out working on the ground with these parents and educating and doing awareness of the Safe Haven law. The Safe Haven law has been around for 20 years. Every state has the Safe Haven law, but the Safe Haven law also basically says that a woman has to walk into a facility and hand their child to a person. And some states require that they ask questions also. The baby box, the only difference that the baby box does or the safety device does is it takes away the face-to-face interaction so that a parent doesn't have to talk to anyone, look anyone in the eye. Last year alone, there was multiple cases of babies that were being found at the doors of Safe Haven locations, even at the doors of hospitals. And so you have to ask yourself, why is a woman going all the way to the hospital but leaving her child at the door of an ER? And it's pretty clear that these parents want the anonymity piece. And so the House Bill 200 doesn't change anything in the law except the way a child is surrendered. Everything that happens after the child is surrendered currently in the state of Montana allows for that to continue. This just gives a woman an option of anonymity. Back in 1973, my birth mom gave birth to me and abandoned me 2 hours after I was born. And so I've dedicated my life to make sure that women have options, that they have a safe place to go if they don't want to, you know, look anyone in the eye. We really work hard on education and awareness because the Safe Haven law, it's not the best option for a parent, but it's the best option if it's the only option a parent has left. We really push adoption and we really push parenting. I hope that you're in favor of House Bill 200. I'd be happy to answer any questions if anyone has any.
Thank you, Ms. Kelsey. We'll take questions after we go through proponents and informational witnesses. So if you could stay online, we'd sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Are there any other proponents online?
Not at this time, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any proponents in the room? If not, we will go to opponents in the room. No?
Madam, I believe someone raised their hand. I'm not sure. For proponents? No. Okay.
I see no opponents in the room. Are there any opponents online?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any informational witnesses? No informational witnesses. We will now go to questions from the committee. Representative Oblander.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Ms. Kelsey. Can you give us a point of reference, the number of these Safe Haven boxes that you distribute on a yearly basis?
We only install about 30, I think 35 last year in 2022, and I think 38 the previous year. You know, this is a voluntary program, so the hospital or the fire station has to want to do the program, and they do their due diligence and look into the program before they do it. We are getting a lot of calls from locations that there have been recent abandonments, and I would hope that a community would be proactive instead of reactive in a community. The baby box or the safety device also is a visual, and I think that's one of the most important things is, you know, when somebody sees a safety device at a fire station and they drive by, they're going to constantly know that that fire station is a Safe Haven location. And so right now, the only thing that we have is word of mouth. You know, there's no state money, and I haven't looked into Montana, but I'm pretty sure Montana doesn't put state money towards education and awareness. It's mostly the nonprofits that are doing that, which we are a nonprofit. And so that is a visual also, which is, of course, an education piece. But on average, that's a really long answer to your question. I apologize. But on average, we install about 35 a year.
Follow up.
Yes, you may follow up.
Thank you, Ms. Kelsey. I think this is a wonderful thing. My follow-up question is fairly simple. What does it cost to build or provide one of these boxes?
And if you could speak through the speaker or through the chairman, we would sure appreciate that.
Madam Chair, Ms. Kelsey, what does it cost to provide one of these boxes?
That's a great question. When I first started Safe Haven Baby Boxes, I didn't want to take any state or federal funds. I wanted to have this as a boots on the ground program where the community rallied around it and helped. And so the fire stations, it doesn't cost the fire stations anything if they don't have, well, I guess I should say this. There's a cost up front for us. Each location, we have to raise at least $11,000. The fire stations and the hospitals usually don't pay that. We usually raise that through private donations and fundraising. If a location wants to do the box program, though, the only thing that they pay per year is a annual recertification fee, which is $300. So if they want to do the baby box program and they don't have the funds raised, we would work with the community to raise those funds so that the location didn't have to put that forth. Average cost, though, of the installation, the box, the media push and stuff like that, you're right at about $15,000.
Thank you, Ms. Kelsey. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any more questions from the committee? Representative Marshall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the sponsor.
Representative Essman.
Madam Chairman, Representative Marshall.
Madam Chair, Representative Ekman. I heard somebody say that they had found a child abandoned in a rural area. There's a lot of rural areas in Montana where there's not fully staffed 24-hour day hospital medical facilities, fire departments, like in our area, it's all volunteer, or even a police station. Is there something else that could be done in those areas where this would be possible?
Representative Marshall, Madam Chair, the baby boxes depend on 24-hour staffing and monitoring to put them in so that the babies don't stay in the boxes. And Ms. Kelsey can speak to this as well, but most babies are in and out of that box in less than 5 minutes. If there isn't a rural abandonment, I just think that if they went to the nearest fire station, the nearest sheriff's office, certainly those people would be able to help them and guide them to a place where there was another safe haven location, like a big fire station. I know there were two cases in the last few years in Montana. One of them was the one that Jill talked about, Ms. Bushman talked about in Missoula County. There was another one in Deer Lodge just in August. Deer Lodge, I know, I don't think has a hospital, but if there was a 24-hour clinic or something there, alarms could be wired anywhere so that someone could go pick those babies up. It just would require a secure location.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Marshall.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Welch, and then we'll go to Representative Yakovich.
Madam Chair, just clarification. Deer Lodge does have a hospital.
Excellent. Even better.
Representative Yakovich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I speak to the sponsor?
You may.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Essman. And Representative Essman. Actually, my father was adopted. And so this is a very important bill to me. But I just want to be clear, as I have in your handout, the box will be established in a designated place like a fire station, and that protocol afterwards would be followed according to state law.
That is correct, Madam Chairman, Representative Yakovich. Nothing in state law is changing as far as a surrender of a child, a newborn. So the box just provides an anonymous place, and Ms. Kelsey, again, may be able to speak more to this, but my understanding is they ask that there's no cameras outside the where the baby box is located so that the parent can remain truly anonymous. There is a packet of material that's left in the baby box clearly marked for the surrendering parent to take so that they can follow up with what their rights are. You know, the same rights, they have 60 days to go claim their baby back if they should decide to do that. There are ways to help them with that. So everything else in the law stays exactly the same. And if there is a face-to-face surrender, it's like it says in the bill, the person who's taking the child may ask that parent to not remain anonymous, to give some heritage of the parent, so that if there is some tribal affiliation that they need to know about, they can document that, and proper channels can be taken care of through whatever tribal affiliation it might be. So there are some really good safeguards built in to the boxes themselves.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Essman.
Madam Chair, Representative Yakovich.
Any further questions from the committee? Representative Essman, would you like to close on your bill?
I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would first like to thank all the proponents that came forward, the ones I knew about and the ones I didn't, and I appreciate everything that they had to say, and I empathize with how hard it was to come and talk about this in front of a committee full of people that they don't know. So I really appreciate that. Thank you. Also, you will notice on your desk you have testimony, written testimony from the Firefighters Association and also from Ms. Browning. We had that printed out and distributed to you as well. And they are in favor of this bill going forward, and I appreciate their efforts. This bill will allow for anonymous surrender of a newborn via a safe haven baby box. The bill adds a definition of what a safe haven or a newborn safety device is. It further defines the surrender of a newborn and provides guidance for face-to-face surrender and access to written materials that describe the parental rights of the parent surrendering. There's no fiscal note to this bill, you'll be happy to know. I'm happy to know. Everything about installing the baby box is completely voluntary and privately funded. Ms. Kelsey told me yesterday that it's 99% privately funded, 1% public, because she had one municipality that actually paid to install their baby box at a location. So that speaks well of the viability of these situations. I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, for your time today and members of the committee, and I urge you to vote do pass on House Bill 200.
This closes the hearing on House Bill 200. Our sponsor for our other bill is not here, so we will recess till she shows up, and I guess I'll just let you know when that happens. We'll stand at ease. Our sponsor has come in the room. If you are part of the Health and Human Services, if you'd like to come in and sit down, we'd sure appreciate it. I'll call Health and Human Services back to order. We'd like to thank the gentleman whose cell phone went off, I believe, yesterday that brought us fruit and cookies. That's you. Oh, thank you so much. If it goes off again, you really don't have to do that, but we really do appreciate it. We will, I'm going to do this right this time. Please silence your cell phones. If you must take a call, please step outside of the committee room. If you wish to give testimony, it's important that you sign your name at the door as a proponent or an opponent. Please note that the information in your testimony is public record. And we will now start the hearing on House Bill 29 with our representative, Jennifer Carlson, presenting that bill. Would you like to open on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Jennifer Carlson, C-A-R-L-S-O-N, representing House District 69 from rural Gallatin County, and I'm here to present to you a committee bill from Children, Family, Health, and Human Services Interim Committee. This bill originally derived from a bill that this committee heard in 21 session from then Representative Tenenbaum on this same topic. And the bill brought up enough questions that it became a study bill for the interim committee. And the study was, what should we do instead of sending people with a primary diagnosis of Alzheimer's, dementia, or traumatic brain injury who do not have a diagnosis of serious and disabling mental illness to the mental hospital? People who do not have a mental illness do not belong in a mental hospital. However, there are some circumstances going on that has made it necessary at times to find a bed, as the state is the caregiver of last resort. And so the interim committee studied this issue with some interest. The interest was quite heightened in the beginning of 2022 when conditions at the state mental hospital became such that the facility received an imminent jeopardy notice from the Federal Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. They were not meeting the requirements to be a facility sanctioned by the federal government. Later in that spring, the facility lost certification. So all of a sudden, this issue came to the forefront of our committee because of the media and the importance surrounding the issue. So that's just a little bit of background for people who are new to the committee, why this was a study bill to begin with. What we determined became this bill. And I'm going to do kind of like I did in judiciary the other day, because it is a complex topic, and rather than rush through and say this is a simple bill, I'm not going to do that. We'll go through the bill and I'll tell you what it says. In the first section of the bill, I'm kind of going to go to the end of section 1, number 7, which is the new language that says an individual with a primary diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, other forms of dementia, or traumatic brain injury may be committed under this part only if the person meets the criteria outlined in 1B1C1D1A, which if we go up to read what that says, includes an individual with a primary diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or other forms of dementia or traumatic brain injury may be committed only if, because of a mental disorder, by act or omission caused self-injury or injury to others, or because of mental disorder there is an imminent threat of injury to self or others, which is a legal standard, by the way, or will predictably become a danger to self or others. There's a theme there, you will notice. If a person is a danger to themselves or others. Included in this bill, it is not acceptable to commit a person to the state mental hospital or another secure facility solely on the basis that they are unable to provide for their own basic needs of food, clothing, shelter, health, or safety. What we know is that sometimes people come to a point in their life where they cannot meet their own basic needs. That does not mean we put them in the most secure facility in the land. It means they need care, and care should be provided for all people in the least restrictive, most appropriate setting. And the least restrictive, most appropriate setting for a person with a primary diagnosis of Alzheimer's is not a state mental institution. If moving on in the bill to section 2, a person must be discharged and the petition dismissed, which is the petition for commitment, must be dismissed if it is determined that the person is not suffering from a mental disorder or does not require commitment within the meaning of this part that I just read, or is suffering from a mental disorder but the primary diagnosis is Alzheimer's dementia or traumatic brain injury and the respondent meets only the commitment criteria that I just read. The next change in the bill is in the same section. I'm just trying to use section numbers because I know my page numbers are different. Section 2, number 7. That says that if the court relies solely upon the criteria that they are unable to care for their needs, their basic needs, the court may require commitment only to a community facility, which may include a Category D assisted living facility, which do not exist at this time, or a program or an appropriate course of treatment as provided in Section 3B, and may not require commitment at the state hospital. That is current law. I just want to point that out. I actually underlined it two times because that's not a change. We should already not be doing this. Now to move on to Section 3, where it says legislative intent. It is the intent of the legislature that geriatric patients at the Montana State Hospital and geriatric residents of the state who may be at risk of commitment to the Montana State Hospital and who do not need intensive psychiatric care receive care and treatment in nursing homes in their community settings. That is current law. We should already not be doing this. Going on to the end of that section, with the addition of, it is the further intention of the legislature to end involuntary commitment of individuals based on, I'm just going to keep reading it. Individuals who have a primary diagnosis of Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia or traumatic brain injury, when those individuals meet only the commitment criteria, which we've mentioned, is they cannot meet their basic needs. We must stop putting those people in this most restrictive place in the state that is not meeting their basic treatment needs. And develop, based on consultation and collaboration between providers in the department, services in the community for those individuals. We are a civil society. We care for vulnerable people. We do it well, and it costs money. But we have to do a good job. The next section is a directive to the department that they will provide that first priority for admissions to nursing homes established in this part be given to Montana State Hospital patients who are geriatric and people with primary diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, other forms of dementia, and traumatic brain injury who have been committed to the state hospital. Going on, I'm shorter than this microphone wants to be. So what that said is stop doing it and start doing better. And that's what we want the department to do. A new section 5 talks about the the rest of the directive to the department is to work at making sure that community placements are available. Transfer funds is authorized. We understand, we acknowledge, we know it is going to cost money to fix this problem. But as I will tell you when I talk about the fiscal note, doing this can save money too. Doing the best thing is also much less expensive than doing the worst thing. By June 30th, 2025, the department will transition out of the state hospital and into community services. The Montana State Hospital patients whose primary diagnosis is Alzheimer's, other forms of dementia, and primary and traumatic brain injury, who do not meet the conditions for commitment that we already talked about. If someone talks to you about this bill and says we're trying to close the Spratt unit at Warm Springs, they are not telling the truth. If someone says we don't want anyone else to be committed to the Spratt unit, they're not telling the truth. Because we are talking about a very specific population of people who can be cared for in the least restrictive, most appropriate setting, which is not the state hospital. The legislature intends for the department to actively pursue the timely discharge of these patients. And to that end, there will be a transition review committee created with representatives serving people with these needs. I'm not going to read the list because you have it in front of you in section 6, but I will tell you it includes 4 legislators, 2 of whom must be from appropriations, and 2 must be from policy. So we got the entire story. This committee will take reports from the department and the Budget and Program Planning Office. They will keep abreast of how many residents in this category are still there, how many are finding placements, what the barriers to care are, and what steps are being taken at the moment to remove the barriers to fixing this problem. This committee will hear reports from providers on matters related to serving individuals with Alzheimer's disease, dementia, and TBI, including but not limited to the information on the resources needed for serving those individuals in the community and taking recommendations for meeting these needs. The individuals in Montana who need care based on their diagnosis of Alzheimer's, dementia, or TBI are not limited to the residents who are currently being housed at the Montana State Hospital. We need to do better. I was in the interim budget committee in December, and we heard a report from Senior Long-Term Care Division that our population of medically needy elderly people is exploding. Right now, the incidence of elder abuse is rising rapidly. The number of elderly Montanans who are dying in their home of neglect is unconscionable. One is too many. We have a duty as a civil society to take care of vulnerable people. We have to do a good job, and it costs money. That is not an excuse not to do it. The other duties of the task force are listed. You can read them yourself. In Section 8, funds appropriated for the department currently for the operation of Montana State Hospital may be used for carrying out this section if these patients are transferred to a community-based nursing home or other community setting, which will, it says that results in, but I'm telling you right now that any community-based setting is going to save money and result in lower expenditures than what we are spending at Montana State Hospital. This bill authorizes that expenditure. There is also a small appropriation in here for the operation of the task force. As you might notice from my presentation, I kind of find this to be a really important issue. I have received a fiscal note for this, which I did not sign, and I wholeheartedly disagree with, frankly, because as you could tell when I was reading it, the intention of this bill is to move these patients to a least restrictive, most appropriate care, which, as the bill points out, is a community-based nursing home facility. The fiscal note numbers are for transferring these people to the Montana State Mental Health Nursing Home in Lewistown, which is another secure facility that also does not accept Medicaid payments. So, in my opinion, the fiscal note is misleading because it gives you an amount of money to move these people to another secure facility when that is not the intention of the bill. I also take issue with the fact that there are currently, according to the report to our committee last, 10 of these individuals at Warm Springs at the date of our last report. The fiscal note has an amount for 12 people in 2025 fiscal year, 18 people in 2026 fiscal year, and 24 people in 2027 fiscal year. And I would like someone to explain where those people exist at the expense of this bill. And at any rate, I can tell you right now that if there were 50 people that fit this category currently living in Montana State Hospital under secure facility arrangement, not receiving the least restrictive, most appropriate care, I would advocate that we spend that money. And I will sit for questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. We'll now open the floor to proponents and opponents. Could you raise your hand if you are a proponent? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And if you're an opponent? 1, 2. We're going to ask that we limit your testimony to 3 minutes today. My current temporary vice chair will be our timer. Will you just kind of do a beep or something for us?
I will, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And if you could, if you just keep our Friday short here, if we could, please. So... if any proponents in the room would come forward, we'd sure appreciate it. And we won't start it with you just doing your name. We'll start it once you start your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Claire Marshall, M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L, and I represent the Alzheimer's Association today. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of House Bill 29, legislation that will ensure people living with dementia in Montana are not involuntarily committed to the state psychiatric hospital. The Alzheimer's Association urges your support of HB 29, as a Montana State Psychiatric Hospital is not adequately prepared to support those living with dementia. The Alzheimer's Association is the leading voluntary health organization for Alzheimer's care, support, and research. In Montana, there are over 22,000 individuals who have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, which is a mind-robbing disease that interferes with daily life. This public health crisis will continue to exacerbate in coming years due to the average lifespans and the expected growth of the population of older Montanans. As care needs increase, people living with dementia are served in a variety of community and residential long-term care settings. Unfortunately, too many are involuntarily committed or involuntarily discharge, from said facilities due to dementia-related behaviors, including hallucinations, delusions, aggression, and agitation. And because they are unable to secure an alternative placement, the individual is instead committed to a state psychiatric facility. The transitions are unnecessary and severely harmful for the person living with dementia, as the state hospital is designed for people with severe mental illness, not dementia, which is a degenerative brain disease. In such settings, people with dementia may be isolated, restrained either physically or medically, housed four patients to a room, and cared for by staff without any knowledge of dementia. Following the 2021 legislative session, the Montana Children, Families, Health, and Human Services Interim Committee studied the issue of Montanans living with dementia who are involuntarily committed to the Montana State Hospital through its HJR 39 study. House Bill 29 was supported and approved by the Interim Committee and lays out a thoughtful and comprehensive approach to reducing involuntary commitments of people living with dementia. An effort to simply prohibit involuntary transfers without any other support will have severe unintended consequences. Any process to reduce involuntary commitments must include stakeholders to help identify and implement community resources and solutions for people who experience dementia-related behaviors and for the care providers that serve them. This legislation successfully accomplishes this by establishing a transition review committee to support the department in developing its plan to end involuntary commitments of people living with dementia. Please support one of Montana's most vulnerable communities by supporting House Bill 29. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee for your time.
Thank you. For those of you in the room that want to know what 3 minutes is like, she was at 2 minutes and 45 seconds. So good job. Next proponent.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and esteemed members of the committee. My name is Sean Conroe, that is C-O-N-R-O-E, and I'm here on behalf of Ability Montana. While I would like to, of course, come here as the social support specialist, I'm also here in a personal matter. We support this bill wholeheartedly. Anything that moves people away from institutions and towards community settings is good in our book. I would like to, however, relate to you a personal matter. And for this bill, I am also a disabled veteran that has sought refuge at a psychiatric inpatient facility and sought refuge from psychosis. And while that is only adjacent to Alzheimer's and dementia-related illnesses, I would like to say that I would rather go to the South Hills, dig a hole in the ground, crawl in it, and die than go to an institutional setting. To that end, I believe that they stand in all respects as an affront to the Olmstead decision of 1999 of our Supreme Court and as an affront to human rights and human dignity across our entire state. I would like to share with you an indictment of the character of the Montana State Hospital and institutions in general. KTVH wrote a news article this past year detailing just what was going on at the Montana State Hospital. I, of course, have copies of this if the committee would like it and it pleases the chair. Quoting, in the meantime, speaking of workers there, in the meantime, she said they've asked administrators at MSH, the consultants currently there, and the other state facilities to identify two data points they can start monitoring to get a better understanding of quality care. Quote, those metrics have never been measured. So it's hard to say what success looks like if you've never measured it, said Rafferty, one of the consultants. Continuing, quote, that's why we're starting from scratch, end quote. I don't think anybody should go there for any reason, but very certainly not people with dementia-related illnesses. Thank you for your time. And if anybody does want copies of that article, I have them for everyone. Thank you.
Just a minute, Mr. Conroy. Does anybody in the room want a copy of that? Okay, we'll just send it down the row for anybody who wants to take it out of the folder.
I've handed several copies of that out, but I believe there are enough for the entire committee.
Thank you. If not, we can get them to our members. Thank you. Next proponent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Kuntz, K-U-N-T-Z. I'm the Executive Director of NAMI Montana. We're a grassroots organization that supports, educates, and advocates for Montanans who live with mental illness and their families. And we do have a different view of the state hospital, which is why I want to go right after is, we do see the state hospital saving lives. A member of my family is alive because of the state hospital. Does not mean that we think it's a great fit for people with Alzheimer's and dementia. I'm a guardian of a woman with Alzheimer's. While I value the state hospital, that's not the right fit. But I do think that a little bit of history is important. We are here because in the interim study of 2013-2014, we studied where was a better place for people with Alzheimer's and dementia. And we sat in this room. We could not come to agreement. So I'm grateful to Representative Carlson and the interim committee for pushing us forward. My assumption is that the opponents to this will have challenges with sections 1 and 2, and we understand that. That is a reason why they are pushed out to 2025. But we really think in one way or another, it would be great to have sections 3 through 11 move forward, because the state hospital is not the right place for people with Alzheimer's and dementia. And when it comes to the fiscal note, back when we were looking in 2013 and 2014, the costs of transitioning people and finding a place for them, we didn't really realize that poor care for patients with Alzheimer's was going to cost the state its CMS certificate and all that money. So there are real costs that come with having people get care in the wrong spot as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coates. Next proponent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rose Hughes, H-U-G-H-E-S, the Executive Director of the Montana Healthcare Association. We represent long-term care, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and some in-home care companies or agencies. We are obviously very interested in older Montanans, and we regularly serve people with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. There doesn't seem to be a lot of question that, for the most part, people with Alzheimer's are not usually an appropriate placement at the state hospital. I also think that our skilled nursing facilities are a likely alternative to that. But I do believe our skilled nursing facilities are often saying no to accepting those residents because of the amount of care they need, perhaps the severity of the behaviors, but largely because we're not funded to provide that care. So this bill says these folks probably don't belong at the state hospital, and we should take a good hard look of how to get them taken care of. And I think we'd love to be a part of that, because I think the important thing is to sit down, have the discussion, figure out what are the needs, what do we need to do to get these people's needs met closer to home, in their communities, whether it's in a nursing facility, assisted living D, or some other provider that we might not yet know. So we need to figure out what they need, what the resources are, and figure out if we can get these people taken care of properly. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hughes. Next proponent.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bernadette Franks Ongoy, FRANKS-ONGOY. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Montana. Disability Rights Montana is a private nonprofit organization, and we are the designated protection and advocacy system for Montanans with disabilities. Our agency has been around since 1977, so that's 46 years, and we're designated by federal law to exist. And the main purpose of our organization is to protect and advocate for Montanans with disabilities. And we have a specific grant that we get from the federal government that allows us to monitor facilities in the state, and we have unfettered access to those facilities. I want to thank Representative Carlson. She did a fabulous job at doing an overview of this bill. Disability Rights Montana, and I personally have been involved with the Montana State Hospital for the last 25 years. I have seen the facility up close, and our organization monitors the facility weekly. It is absolutely, I'm even stumbling for the right word, it's outrageous that we would put people with dementia, Alzheimer's, and people with traumatic brain injury in a facility that is state licensed as a mental health facility. People with Alzheimer's, dementia, and traumatic brain injury require a particular level of care that the staff at the Montana State Hospital are not trained to provide. It's just not appropriate for anybody with that diagnosis to be at that hospital. We are incredibly grateful for the interim committee's work in coming up with this bill and starting to finally take steps for the promise of the Supreme Court Olmstead decision that says that we need to treat people in community settings, appropriate community settings. This isn't going to happen overnight. We recognize that this is a big project and it's going to take a lot of time and there's a lot of moving steps. I think it's appropriate that we have a transition committee that works with the department and has this actually come forward and that we really come up with a better way to treat people in the community. I'm very incredibly grateful for bringing this bill forward, and we stand ready to work in any capacity in having this bill passed and people being able to live in community settings. Thank you very much.
Before you leave, could you tell us your organization one more time?
Disability Rights Montana.
Thank you. Next proponent.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Adrian Cotton, C-O-T-T-O-N, here representing AARP Montana and our 140,000 members who all urge your support for House Bill 29. Our belief is that older Montanans and caregivers should be provided a variety of residential and community-based care options. We firmly believe in maintaining the rights and freedoms of individuals in advancing age, and that home and community-based services should be both bolstered and prioritized. We very much appreciate the bipartisan efforts of the Children, Family, Health, and Human Services Committee, as well as we would like to extend our gratitude to Representative Carlson for carrying this bill. We urge it to pass, and I'll also pass along the support of the Area Agencies on Aging, who, alongside their support, wish to express great surprise at the fiscal note. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Cotton, next proponent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maggie Bornstein, spelled B-O-R-N-S-T-E-I-N, here on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union of Montana to express our support for House Bill 29. For all the reasons aforementioned, we would certify the legitimacy of the Olmstead decision and really holding the state to account and moving this forward. And we would also, while we have the opportunity, like to express support of this on behalf of Montana Women Vote, who couldn't be here in the room, but who also very significantly cares about this issue. So we thank you for the opportunity, and we thank Representative Carlson for bringing this forward. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Bornstein. Any other proponents in the room? Are there any proponents online?
Madam Chair, we have a proponent online. Is Danny Tenenbaum?
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Human Services Committee. My name is Danny Tenenbaum. I'm a former legislator, and I also used to work as a public defender. A few years back, while working for OPD, I represented a Korean War veteran from Eastern Montana, and he had Alzheimer's. And he was involuntarily committed to the state hospital hundreds of miles away in Warm Springs. There were no reports of violence in his record, no co-occurring mental illnesses, just the typical symptoms that you see with this disease: confusion, memory loss, and an inability to consistently care for his own basic needs. He did not receive care at the state hospital. He was housed in the dilapidated Spratt unit in what looked like a cell with three other people who were also living with dementia. I was shocked when I realized that this is how our government treats Montanans with his disease. I am really happy that the committee has the opportunity to fix this longstanding problem and allow people with dementia and traumatic brain injuries to live in a safe and dignified community environment. There's just a couple things that I want to highlight. On page 3, lines 18 through 20, the bill cross-references a different statute, 53-21-126 at the end, and that's a really important part of the bill. There are a couple ways that a person can be involuntarily committed. One is if a person is a danger to themselves or others, and the other is if a person has just lost the ability to provide for their own basic needs like food, water, shelter. This bill only applies to people in the latter category. It does not affect the state's ability to involuntarily commit a person who presents a danger, even if they have Alzheimer's or a traumatic brain injury. The other thing I'd like to emphasize is this bill's effective date. Initially, the interim committee was considering just the default July 2023 effective date for this legislation. But after talking with the department and stakeholders, we pushed it to July 2025.
1 minute.
We chose that date because we wanted to create oversight of the transition in the coming years and also allow the next legislature to make any necessary changes based on lessons learned. Finally, as state legislators, you have the ability to visit the state hospital and the Spratt unit to observe firsthand the current situation. Last year, a group of us visited. Thank you, Representative Gillette, for arranging. And I hope this committee reaches out to the department and sets up another visit as soon as possible. It's very informative. Thank you very much. And thank you to Representative Carlson for this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tannenbaum. Any other proponents online?
Madam Chair, we have Shyla Patera.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the House Human Services Committee. For the record, my name is Shyla Patera, and I represent North Central Independent Living, one of four of Montana's independent living centers, who definitely see promise in the proposed passage of House Bill 29, because it does advance community services in Montana for those that have dementia, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. And it also sets up safeguards so that we can determine the system of when a person is a danger to themselves, others, and the community. I also come before you as a family member of a person and persons with Alzheimer's, and I can truly say that I really am glad for Representative Carlson bringing this bill forward, because those of us in the family world now have ways to judge when behaviors and legal standards make the start of good policy. I really admire, like others have said, the transition committee, and really look forward to working with House Human Services and the Section B budget over the next period of time to ensure that we really advance community services and the best community settings for those with Alzheimer's, dementia, and traumatic brain injury, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Patera. Any other proponents online?
Madam Chair, no.
Thank you. Any opponents in the room?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm William Evo. Last name is spelled E, V as in Victor O. I'm the Chief Healthcare Facilities Officer here in the state of Montana for DPHHS, and I joined the department in May of 22. I'm also joined by Chad Parker, our Deputy Chief Legal Counsel. First and foremost, I want to tell this group that we absolutely understand the intent of this bill and do want to partner with you. Although, as currently written, we do also very respectfully oppose the bill, mostly on technical matters, and I'd like to share a little bit about that. We've supplied a suggested draft of changes that can make a portion of the bill work, and generally, however, because of the 1.5 to 2 year minimum time frame for adjustment of infrastructure, the timelines stated in the bill are too rigid. We are currently and have been working to resolve these issues independently and even without House Bill 29 serving as a statutory spur. We submit the understanding the problems associated with this bill, and hearing potential fixes will be useful for the committee's consideration, and I'll be sharing about five of those items. First, the draft mandates discharge of patients, and it does this without individual consideration of patient needs and best interests, without statewide infrastructure in place, and without sufficient time or funding to create such infrastructure. Two, the draft also removes judicial, county attorney, and defense counsel input and discretion from commitment and recommitment process. The result is that patients suffering from mental disorders that coexist with Alzheimer's, dementia, and traumatic brain injury cannot be involuntarily committed when appropriate, and such patients are likely to be deprived of essential treatment, especially in low-resource locations. A significant number of individuals will be discharged from state facilities and into the community, and this will require the department to negotiate placement into private facilities at significantly increased cost, if possible, or into the community at large without provision for their safety. As there's no current infrastructure into which these individuals can be placed, there's likely no way to create such an infrastructure and place these patients or respondents without risking their safety and depriving them of treatment needs within the time constraints proposed. So the fix here would be to alter the dates by which the transition must be accomplished. Three, the draft does not change the definition of a mental disorder. And the result is that individuals with an alleged primary diagnosis of Alzheimer's, dementia, or traumatic brain injury can still be involuntarily committed despite HB 29 prohibitions.
1 minute.
The fix is to create additional new section wherein the definition for mental disorder is altered, stating explicitly that Alzheimer's, dementia, and traumatic brain injury are not a mental disorder. And this is already done within addiction, intoxication, intellectual disability, and epilepsy by listing them as exceptions. And I would refer the group to MCA 5321-102, subsection 9. Four, the draft creates confusion in section 1, subsection 7, by using new numerical references, resulting in inconsistent commitment dismissals and discharges resulting from confusion over which conditions still allow for involuntary commitment. The changes treat inability to meet basic food, clothing, shelter, health, or safety needs as wholly separate from danger to self or others. The reality is that a person who cannot meet their basic food, clothing, shelter, health, or safety needs often is a danger to self or others because of those things if left untreated. Okay. The fix would be to not recognize MCA 53-21-126 subsection D or repeat the language in the reorganized 126 subsection D. Explicitly state which conditions do and do not allow for commitment or recommitment. Lastly, the draft fails to use consistent language in section 5, subsection 4, resulting in potential for inconsistent results and confusion for courts, county attorneys, the department, and stakeholders. And the fix would be to amend section 5, subsection 4. Thank you very much for your time.
That was very good. Thank you. On timing. Next proponent. Opponent. I'm sorry. Next opponent. There is not one. Is there any opponents online?
Madam Chair, no, not at this time.
We will now go to informational witnesses. I see none in the room. Is there any informational witnesses online?
Madam Chair, no, and not at this time.
We will now open our hearing to questions from the committee. Representative Nikolakos, I'm not even going to try.
Nico Works. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the bill sponsor.
Madam Chair, Representative Nikolakos.
Madam Chair, Representative, so I mean, I think it's pretty intuitive to most of us that folks with dementia don't belong in the mental health facility. I mean, in the mental health, mental state hospital. So what, for those of us who weren't on the interim committee, and I understand that this legislation provides for a transitional committee, but for those of us who aren't really as dialed in and who are newer, what are some of the leads, like the potential leads for that, that transitional committee would look at as far as placement for these individuals, if those exist, as far as some ideas that you're fleshing out?
So I'm assuming a few
through the
things.
Chair.
Madam Chair, I'm going to assume a few things, Representative, and if I assume too much, interrupt me, but I'm assuming you are aware that there are, we have had 11, I believe, nursing homes close in the past 1 year. We have a lot of other nursing homes in the state currently at a very low census. That is primarily because the Medicaid daily reimbursement rate for those facilities is too low. It has not been raised in a long time, and it is currently at approximately $100 under the cost of care. So the facilities have to maintain a certain ratio of caregivers to patients, and at the low reimbursement, they are just not able to hire enough caregivers to fill the empty beds. Most of these facilities have waiting lists. If the daily reimbursement rate for nursing homes is raised to a rate that meets the needs of those facilities, they will, we have been assured, attempt to hire staff and have those beds available. There are times when the people who have been committed to Warm Springs could have physically been cared for in a nursing home in their community, but there was not a bed available. However, if you look at the facility, you see a bed that is available. But the problem is staffing of the facility is not possible at the daily reimbursement rates. So we have been also assured by the Montana Nursing Home organization, you heard from Rose Hughes today, that if the rate was significant or was sufficient for their needs, they would take these people. So I don't agree that having a date of 2 years from this summer is too soon. What is necessary is that they become reimbursed and are able to provide the care, and then they will provide the care. So hopefully I answered your question and gave enough information, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Oblander, and then we'll go to Representative Marshall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for the sponsor too, please. Thank you for bringing this before this committee. I appreciate the concerns that have been expressed. You had talked about on page 5 a Category D assisted living facility. Can you explain what that is in relation to other categories?
I will do my best, Madam Chair, and then it possibly could be redirected to Ms. Hughes. A Category D assisted living facility. This interim, there were new rules proposed for Category D assisted living, which is a special category of more medically needy, higher needs elderly patients. And to be honest, Madam Chair, if I could redirect that to Rosie, as I'd feel a lot more comfortable about the use of the answer.
You may redirect. Ms. Hughes? Ms. Hughes?
Madam Chair, Representative, Category D assisted living was developed several years ago by the legislature, specifically with the hope that the kind of individuals that we're talking about here would benefit from that level of care. It took years for the department to actually develop the rules. The rules came out within the last year or so. They're more directed toward mental health needs and they assume some mental health needs. So it is unclear if assisted living category D is going to solve much of this problem, because in some ways we're talking about people who maybe don't have mental health needs. Their main diagnosis is Alzheimer's, which is something different. But it's a category that exists. It may be developed, and it may be helpful for some of the individuals. It's an option.
Follow up?
Yes, you may follow up.
Thank you, Ms. Hughes. So we heard testimony about there being beds available, but because of the reimbursement rates, the beds aren't available because you can't meet that requirement. If that was changed and people could come home, essentially, to be closer to their family, that's huge. And the other side of that is, comment was made about 2 years plus, and there was opposition to that. Do you think that that 2 years is too long?
Madam Chair, Representative Oblender, I don't see the dates in the legislation, the proposed legislation, as being a problem because of the fact, you know, there's an escape valve. You meet before that date comes. So if for some reason there's not an ability to really get this job done, you're going to be able to have some say-so about what that date should be. What I find is when you pass a bill like this, you are telling the agency, this is important to us, focus on it. Because, you know, the agency could have been doing this all along, but they have lots of things they do. So they're doing the best they can with the priorities they have to do their work. But if you think this is a high priority and you say work on it and work on it now, then you're speaking as to what your priorities are. And I do think that that's an important piece. And I think the farther you put out the date, the more you delay the activity.
Thank you, Ms. Hughes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mrs. Hughes. Representative Marshall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the sponsor.
Madam Chair, Representative Marshall.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, the fiscal note, you get some angst with that. What numbers would you say were involved in this rather than the fiscal note? What's more realistic in your opinion? Do you have an idea?
Well, as you look at the fiscal note, regardless of the number of patients, which I'm having some trouble with the number of patients, on page 2 of the fiscal note, there, as you see, because we know at this time there are not that many of these individuals. But my main problem with the fiscal note is we are exchanging one very expensive facility that does not take Medicaid for another very expensive facility that also does not take Medicaid. So I had the budget office help me understand this. They attempted. I thank him very much for his information. And I ran some math with the exact same number of people involved. And I used the number $278 per day, because that is what a Guidehouse recommended in the Guidehouse nursing home rate study that just came out. Their recommendation for nursing home reimbursement rate was $278 a day. Currently, the rate is $208 a day. So if you ran that number for 12 people for 1 year, and take into consideration that that charge is 65 roughly percent paid by the federal match for Medicaid, the cost would be about $425,000 a year for those 12 people. The fiscal note assumes that those people will be going to the mental health nursing home in Lewistown at a cost of $2.1 million. So as you can see, that's quite a big difference between 426,000 and 2.1 million. Then when you get to fiscal year 27 with 24 individuals in that box, it is $4.476 million. And if you did what the bill instructs, which is to move people to a least restrictive placement in a community-based setting in a nursing home that does take Medicaid, that cost would be $852,000 for those same 24 individuals to the state instead of $4.476 million.
Okay. Follow-up?
Yes, you may follow up.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson. So, giving excellent, giving those numbers, and we heard from Ms. Hughes on the and yourself as well about the gap in the Medicaid payments. What would be the number required across the board to fill that gap, so that we could get these people need to be in a nursing home. They don't need to be in a state facility. What is it going to take to get that done?
Madam Chair, would it be possible for me to redirect that question to Ms. Hughes?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you may. Ms. Hughes?
Madam Chair, Representative, you're asking about the cost to fill the gap between current rate and, okay. So to get to the 278 that the study says is what it should be, the study estimated that the total cost, state and federal, was about $54-55 million, and that the state share was 19, and that's on an annual basis. I would add that if these individuals are particularly difficult to provide, well, I would add that we don't agree that 278 is the right number, because they imposed some penalties. They developed what the cost was, and then they reduced the cost significantly. So the average cost is closer to $350 a day and not $278 a day. And that is what we're going to be asking, you know, in the budget subcommittees and so forth. That's where we're at on an average rate. If these people are more difficult than average, and we don't know, because if they're typical Alzheimer's people, we take care of Alzheimer's people. We do that. That's what we do. But if they are particularly, if they have many very difficult behaviors or whatever, it could be that some of these individuals will require more than that. It might have to be a negotiated rate. I don't know. I suspect wholeheartedly that it will be less than what you're spending now, by quite a bit.
Okay. Thank you. I have one more question for Mr. Evo, DPHHS.
Mr. Evo, thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair and Representative Marshall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Evo. I'm saying that right, am I?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, Mr. Evo, so given the numbers that you just heard, I know one of the complaints was that the time frame and building the infrastructure and everything. So let me ask you this. If that money was put into this and this was funded, would there be a problem getting this done in 2 years?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Marshall, I would defer to the group to the testimony from last week in Section B regarding the state's evolving plans to support the transition for patients from the SPRAT unit. And so I couldn't speak to the exact time frame, but I know there is particular budget asks there to support elements of that plan and to sync up with those timelines from a budget standpoint would be my best response to that question.
Okay, it's a quick follow-up, Madam Chair, yes. Mr. Evo. So, in other words, I should redirect to APPROPES?
just Madam Chair, Representative Marshall, there's was a long discussion around what the department is trying to do in that regard, and I understand there's certain time frames associated with our budget asks, and so the department's ask, you know, here on this topic is to sync that up for our ability to take care of those patients per our plan that was stated in Section B with House Bill 2.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Stafford.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but my question was already answered.
That's where I'm waiting to get them.
Are there any other questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Mr. Evo.
Madam Chair, and who?
Over here.
Oh, sorry. Representative Smith.
Thank you. I have two questions that are connected. Do you have current numbers on how many individuals there are that meet each of these criteria that are on Section 4, line 26? So geriatric, Alzheimer's disease, other forms of dementia, and then traumatic brain injury. Do you have those numbers?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I believe so, but not certainly cannot speak to that currently, not prepared to speak to that currently.
Do you have a ballpark?
I would prefer not to give a ballpark.
Please talk to the chair instead of to each other.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Representative Smith, I would like to not ballpark and be very specific so that I can very intentionally be able to answer questions for this committee. So
I appreciate that. You're answering that like an attorney.
Thank you.
So my question that's related to it is when I look at that section, and I just want to confirm that I understand it correctly. So currently, under Section 4 on line 24, the state already shall provide that geriatric residents to the state hospital have first priority. And so as I understand it, the bill expands that to one category, which is state hospital patients who are geriatric, and then now the second category for priority, which combines Alzheimer's, other forms of dementia, or traumatic brain injury. And so is that correct?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Smith.
With the caveat of the additional.
Sure, yeah. And I'll say that although I answered the last question as an attorney, if you'd like to ask a technical question about the language of the bill, I'd respectfully request to be able to defer to Chad Parker, Deputy Chief Legal Counsel, that's here with me today. Would that be appropriate?
That would be appropriate.
Okay, thank you very much. Chad, could you? Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, if you could give me a little bit more on that, just one more
yes,
time.
Yes, and I think my actual question may be more for Mr. Evo. I guess I'm looking
chair,
at the
chair, please.
Oh, Madam Chair. My apologies. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is I see the phrase that the department shall provide that first priority for admission goes to these multiple groups. And so among the sort of priorities, how do you decide how individuals rank within those priorities? Because there are, as I see it, four different groups of people that are a priority.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I believe, as you know, because you're a lawyer as well as yep. I am, and you've been in court before, we understand exactly how a lot of these things actually come to the department. Mm-hmm. They are not decisions that are made independently by the department, first and foremost. They go through not only county attorneys, they also go through the judges, and they have to make decisions about which individuals should first and foremost be committed. And then the criteria for those commitments come in an order. Those orders come to the department. The department then takes that order, will sometimes consult with OLA, the Office of Legal Affairs, and then the clinical staff will also look at the professional person's recommendations and reports that are attached not only to the first petition, but also to the order. Those kinds of interpretations that are filtered to the department, that's how it gets to us. Then that decision is made if they are in fact meeting those criteria per the court order, per the commitment. That's where they were then routed, okay? And that's how the prioritization happens. Does that answer your question?
Madam Chair, not quite. Can I ask a follow-up?
You may.
So I absolutely follow that process and understand it. I guess what I'm asking is for then the discharge process, we now have priority for four different groups. And this might be a question, maybe even for the sponsor, is how do we contemplate among those four groups who has the outgoing priority to the nursing homes?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, once again, with regards to transfer of individuals, despite the language that's inserted here, it talks about giving direction to the department to prioritize these individuals, but a transfer of a commitment still happens when a person has a mental disease or disorder, coupled most of the time, almost exclusively Alzheimer's plus is the situation that we're faced with. That's why the recommendation of the department is to add a section, and we've submitted this amendatory language to the sponsor of the bill. We discussed it at length during the interim committee session about addressing some of the core features that a court has to determine. These questions about transfer or recommitments and everything else like that are still going to be not done independently with the department. The department isn't the sole decider on these questions. So if we're going to transfer or put someone else in another jurisdiction, we have to go back to the court to do that. We can't just solely go, okay, we're discharging this person, you're discharging that person there, except for on a temporary basis. Whenever you have someone who has initially been committed and you're looking at transferring these individuals before the termination of a commitment, because that's what you'd be dealing with here, you have to go back to the district court, ask to either have the recommitment petition dismissed or changed, and then the district court still has discretion over those matters. The core issue that we take with most of the language in this bill is the fact that it tries to remove that discretion from both the department as well as the courts when there are so many other interacting pieces of law here that the bill, frankly, as written, does not accomplish the intent. We recognize the intent. We recognize the needs. We also recognize the concerns that surround Alzheimer's patients. It is a severe problem. It's something that we are not dispassionate about this. We understand this. And working on the language is something that Mr. Evo presented to you, saying we stand in opposition primarily on technical grounds. He went through those five primary objections, but each of those five primary objections relate specifically to the functionality and the mechanics of how this works. Most of the testimony did not address the mechanics and the functionality of how this works. Hopefully that answers the question.
Thank you.
Before you leave the podium, we did not get your name officially in the record, and we need to put you down as an opponent to the bill. At first we thought you were an informational witness, but it kind of turned to opponent. So if you could give us how the spelling of your name is, we'd sure appreciate it.
Madam Chair, gladly. It is Chad Parker, and that's spelled P-A-R-K-E-R. And I am Deputy Chief Legal Counsel for the Department of Public Health and Human Services.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? I'm seeing, we'll do Representative Oblander and then back to Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be for, the name just escaped me. Ms. Hughes, sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Oblander.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hughes. So my understanding is that we've had 13 facilities closed around the state so far. Is that correct?
11.
Okay, thank you. And follow up?
Follow up, please, through the chair.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hughes. So if the approximately $278 per day came in, or it went up to the $350 estimate, are there, with those facilities closing, is there still enough beds available, rooms available, that these people could be transitioned out and receive the care that they need appropriately in their own communities, hopefully?
Madam Chair, Representative Oblander, yes, there are empty beds in our facilities throughout the state. And so, right person, right circumstance, and we would do our very best to try to serve these people locally.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, I have a question for the sponsor, and I promise it will be short.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith.
Representative Carlson, I think about the different systems that are involved here, so the state hospital and then the court system and all the sort of interacting pieces. Would you entertain an amendment that would add a member in the transition review committee that is a representative of the judges of the judiciary that is involved in this?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think it would be the duty of the committee at that point if there was an amendment.
Thank you.
I would hesitate to give my opinion on an amendment I have not seen.
Fair enough.
Question? Yes, Representative Nichol.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Representative Carlson.
Representative Carlson?
Madam Chair, Representative Nichol.
So I used to work in nursing homes. I did for 2 years, and I specialized in Alzheimer's unit care. Do they still have the same Alzheimer's unit care portions that they did? I don't want to date myself, but 20 some years ago, or is it now just a locked facility where the Alzheimer's residents are in with the other regular care residents?
Madam Chair, Representative Nichol, for clarification, do you mean in a standard community-based nursing home, or are you talking about Montana State Hospital?
I am talking about a standard nursing home situation.
If I could redirect that to Rose Hughes, I don't know what you mean by that. So,
okay.
And I wasn't there 20 years ago either. So,
Mrs. Hughes.
Madam Chair, Representative Nichol, unfortunately, I have been around this over many years, so I can visit with you about what was going on. To respond to your question, it varies. So there are definitely separate closed units, in some cases even locked memory care units in the nursing facilities. In other facilities, they provide dementia care amongst the population as a whole. So it really depends from one facility to the other. But a number of them do, in fact, have memory care units, as they seem to be called these days.
Okay, follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if there is, since we are seeing more of the memory care people placed in with regular nursing home care in these facilities, if you think that is going to speed up the time of integrating these Alzheimer's people back into the private care facilities.
Madam Chair, Representative Nichol, it does depend on what these individuals look like and what their needs are. If we're dealing with people with some pretty severe behaviors, you're probably going to be looking for a facility with a memory care unit so that they can provide that specialized care rather than attempting to introduce this individual into the general population. So it really, those kinds of decisions really are made on a case-by-case basis based on the needs of the individual.
Okay, thank you.
Madam, Ms. Hughes, would you stay there for a minute? I have a question. Is there any other questions in the room? Would you define for us the difference between someone who has Alzheimer's, somebody who has dementia, and somebody who has memory care?
we're kind of getting confused up here.
Madam Chair, I'll try. That's slightly more clinical than I am. But so Alzheimer's disease, they refer to Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. Alzheimer's disease is pretty specific when they look at the deterioration, a certain type of deterioration of the brain. There are several different kinds of dementias, and I can't name them all. You know, frontal lobe. They're in categories, and they're each a little different. They require a little different care. When you talk about memory care, I think that's a term that people use to describe care for any of those. For Alzheimer's or the related dementias, they refer to it, if they have a specialized unit, they'll refer to it as a memory care unit, just because loss of memory is one of the main things that you see across all of those different kinds of dementia.
Thank you. I have another question. So my experience with Alzheimer's, some people get mean, some people get nicer. So in your care facilities, you would have, like, you keep talking about behaviors. Those are behaviors. And in the state hospital, I would assume some of those people was because of their behavior they ended up in the state hospital, not necessarily because of Alzheimer's. Am I going down the right road there in thinking why people end up in different spots?
Madam Chair, people with Alzheimer's definitely respond differently to the disease and as the disease progresses. So some people are happy the entire time. Some people forget more than others. Some people don't know their family. Some people do get violent and aggressive and angry. So you have all of that. I think the memory care facilities are prepared to deal with most of those things. When you ask about the people at the state hospital, I become a little confused because I am hearing that these people perhaps are not a danger to themselves or others, which is typically the category they might fall into if they're getting very violent and have, you know, those kinds of behaviors. And so if they're not in that kind of extreme category, then they might look more like a more average person, if there's any such thing, with Alzheimer's. So again, without knowing for sure what these individuals are like, it's just hard to say exactly where, you know, where they would fit in.
Thank you. Could we readdress that? Come on up.
Madam Chair, if it does, please, I can stand as an informational witness on the technical aspects of your two questions. Sorry, Madam Chair, Sean Connor, Social Support Specialist, Ability Montana. I am not a clinician. I am, however, an MSW candidate and can speak with at least a limited amount of authority on your former question and through personal experience and work for the past year to your second question.
Let me just ask the committee, are we okay with him being there? Okay, thank you.
To your former question, dementia is a subset of neurocognitive disorders within the DSM, the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual. This involves biological markers as well as psychosocial symptoms that determine that somebody is generally speaking deficient in several or one or more categories of activities of daily living. Alzheimer's stands as a subset of dementia. It stands next to frontal lobe, as Ms. Hughes mentioned, but also Lewy bodies and other sorts of transient memory care problems. As far as memory care, it's not particularly well-defined, but generally speaking applies to the actual therapies provided to these people, whether it's occupational therapy skills or if it's communication speech pathology. Those can all fall under the idea of memory care. It is poorly defined, but generally speaking is there to help somebody live as maximally an independent life as they can, even inside a residential facility.
And now Representative Marshall has a question for you, please.
Sprung a leak, hit a cord. Madam Chair, you said you were in the facility at Warm Springs for a while.
Madam Chair, Representative, not at Warm Springs. I was at a VA, a Veterans Affairs psychiatric facility out of this state. I would like to say, however, that that experience was awful and also less restrictive.
Okay, follow up.
Yes, ma'am.
Madam Chair, sir. You've been to Warm. Do you know if they, judging because we have different levels here, we have people, happy people, as Ms. Hughes said, or people who get violent. Do you know if they diagnose these people and separate them according to that? Or are they putting just, you know, you could have one person who's extremely violent in with somebody who's extremely happy, and the next thing you end up with patients getting unnecessarily hurt? And do you know if that happens?
Madam Chair, Representative, I cannot speak to the clinical decisions of the Montana State Hospital. I have no knowledge to that end.
Can I open it up for somebody who may know? I redirect to anybody who may know that.
Ms. Franks Ongoy?
Madam Chair, Representative, as I indicated in my opening remarks, our organization monitors the state hospital, and so we have some knowledge of that. Right now, this week, there's 37 people in what is called the SPRAT unit, and that's, I think, the question Representative Smith was trying to ask, and a lot of those folks have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's or some sort of dementia, and one of the largest things that they experience are falls. They fall. They're older people that need a level of care that is more appropriate for nursing homes. When you ask the question whether they put people with violent behaviors with other folks, I think the hospital tries their darndest to separate those people. That being said, they're all, most of them are on one unit. And so the unit is very, it's very difficult to separate them out appropriately. Most of the, too bad you don't have a map of the facility in front of you. The unit is set up that most folks are four people to a room. And so there are some, and so they're living in congregate settings. So it does turn out to be an unsafe situation. I hope I'm answering your question.
Perfect. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may answer your second question that you asked.
Committee, okay? All right.
Your second question referenced whether these behaviors are contributing factors to these civil commitments. Over the past 8 or 9 months, Ability Montana has conducted an informal survey of county attorneys within our service area, which is the 14 counties of Southwest Montana. We found that, generally speaking, the process is kind of as follows. A clinician, the county attorney, and the judge sit down and figure out if this person can care for themselves, if anybody in the community can care for themselves, and if there are available community resources. Failing all of those, they head to Warm Springs. Generally speaking, as I understand it, when speaking with these county attorneys, the primary concern has largely been, can they care for themselves, and are they a danger to themselves? It's usually very rarely a danger to somebody else, and those are the contributing factors. Now, negative behaviors may fall as a subset of danger to oneself, but generally speaking, the disposition of the person, I do not believe, is regularly considered.
Representative Vice Chair Buckley, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for the sponsor.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, Representative, my understanding as you were working through this over the course of the interim is that the provider rate study wasn't finalized as you were putting that this together. Is that right, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Buckley, that is correct.
Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'm looking at Section 8, and I'm thinking about your comments. I'm thinking about Ms. Hughes' comments about how this will add pressure to our provider rate increases, which is a central part of this conversation, but couldn't be addressed in the bill because it was working in tandem with the provider rate study that was going on. And I'm wondering if there's a possibility you would entertain a conversation around having a specific number of funds appropriated or to tie it more specifically to the provider rate increase to ensure that as we are moving residents who should not be at Warm Springs out of the state hospital to community-based centers, that there's appropriate funding and support and infrastructure and resources for them and their home communities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Buckley, I'm hoping I understand your question. I haven't had a long time to study the nursing home guidehouse recommendations yet, but I have gone through it once quickly. There is a chart in there. There's probably a few people behind me that have a lot better idea of what I'm talking about, but there is an add-on for nursing homes in the provider rate, mm-hmm. which allows a facility to take an additional payment if they accept a patient who, I'm just trying to remember, there were several categories. One is who shows sexually problematic behavior. One category, I believe, is if they are a flight risk. Basically, if you're familiar with memory care, a lot of people can wander off. And so there is an add-on for that. And I know there's one other. I don't remember what it is. But if that answers your question, that is taken into consideration, to the best of my knowledge, in the rate study. Of course, the rate study has not been accepted. It's only been proposed. And, of course, Section B will have a lot of discretion as to what it ends up looking like, but does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you. We'll just have to make sure this works closely with the work of Section B. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to the sponsor.
Thank you. And I just, Madam Chair, I did remember another part of the answer there, which is I had a conversation with someone in Section B a few days ago, and they said there is a possibility that there is a mechanism to develop another category on that chart that would be receives a patient from institutional care. So I think I understand your question now, and that may be something that we can do. Madam Chair.
I see no other hands. Would the sponsor like to close on her bill? And if you could, tell us the difference between the state hospital and the hospital that's in Lewistown. I think it got a little bit blurry for us.
It is a little bit blurry. Madam Chair, before I close, I'll just answer your question. The Montana State Hospital is an institutional facility for people with serious and disabling mental illness. And there might be another definition, but for the best of your knowledge, your use, it is a facility for people with mental illness, and sometimes it's because people have committed acts against others that causes them to go there. The Montana State Mental Health Nursing Home is a nursing home, primarily for set up as you would see a nursing home. And it is for elderly patients who are more medically needy. And I know the Mr. Evo, that's his job. So if you need more explanation, he would be able to give it. So it's a different animal. They're both secure facilities, though, so neither one of them is, well, it's a secure facility, so it doesn't take Medicaid. Montana State Hospital has lost its certification due to problematic reports, and so they also do not take Medicaid. I'm not going to give a long close because this was a good hearing. There were a lot of good questions here. I'm just going to touch on a couple of things that were brought up in questions to someone else. For Ms. Representative Smith asked about how many people with these diagnoses were in question, and I do have a chart here from the interim committee. In 2019, there were 20 of those residents throughout the year. In 2020, there were 30 throughout the year. That may be due to some COVID issues with local facilities. In 2021, as of September 13th, there were 10. So it's not a large number at the time. At this time, I also wanted to just briefly touch on the discharge procedure in section. Two, I believe it is, a respondent must be discharged and the petition dismissed upon trial, which means that a judge is making that determination. That was brought up, and I just wanted to mention that determination is made by a judge, just the same as a commitment is. And then there was one other question that came up, and it had to do with Section 4, regarding another question from Representative Smith, where it was talking about priority for admission to these nursing homes established under this section. And there aren't actually four categories of people listed there. There are people who are patients at MSH right now, and there are people with the diagnosis of dementia who have been committed to the hospital but no longer need the treatment there or are substantially unable to care for their needs. So there are two categories. Both must be involuntary committed or... so anyway, I just wanted to point that out, that there were not four categories of people there. All that to say, there was a lot of good questions, a lot of answers. If you have more questions later, if something comes up, I know that any member of the committee would be happy to talk to you. I do have the reports available that the interim committee looked at, and a lot of data is available there. I wanted to talk about the... I did mention one thing of the objection of the opponents about the discharge. That determination is made by a judge. It's not made by the department. There was a discussion in the opposition about cost, and I can tell you right now, unquestionably, there is not a category of care in this state that costs more than Montana State Hospital. Nursing homes will take these patients if the reimbursement is sufficient. And as to Representative Buckley's point, there might be some things that we could do to even have an add-on for nursing homes who agree to take patients who are being discharged from institutions. The one request for an amendment that came up regarding putting a member of county attorneys or a judge or someone with the legal knowledge onto that that task force, that transition committee, is an amendment that probably should be seriously considered by this committee. And please ask me in the hall or ask a member of the committee if you have more questions, but it is past time to fix this problem, and we have the power to do it, and we also do have that safety valve that was mentioned. The legislature will meet one more time before the effective date of this bill. So if it's not working out and the transition review committee says we're going to need more time, then we can do that. But I've learned one thing, and that is if you don't tell somebody to do it, a lot of times they will not choose to do it. Thank you, and I urge you to pass.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. I would just like to have a reminder that if you did not sign up at the door and you testified, we need you for you to sign up for that. And we will close on our hearing today for House Bill 29. And we will make a motion to adjourn our hearing today. We're done.
My pleasure. Army, I was a medic for the 3rd Division. Yep. Spent about all of 2008 in Iraq, you know. Best of time, worst of times, that sort of thing.
I'm going to do it.
Without the browsers.
What's your thinking? What is your deal?